Ink and Paint wishes to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people, the traditional owners of the land on which this podcast is recorded and edited. It is a great privilege to be able to tell stories on this land, which has a tradition of storytelling stretching back over 10,000 years. We also wish to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands from all over the world where our guests record from. We pay our respects to all elders past, present, and emerging, and to our First Nations listeners.
This entire operation puts one in mind of a symphony orchestra, where men who are good enough to be soloists in their own right are thinking only of the effect they are producing on the whole.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Ink and Paint, a podcast journey through the Disney animated classics. I'm your host, Daniel Lamon. We're exploring one by one the films in the official Disney animated canon and talking about their artistic, historical, and social context, where they come from, their impact, and how they sit with us now. In our last episode, we began our two-part look at the monumental Disney classic, Sleeping Beauty, how it came to be and how it began to spin out of control, and talked about the influence of Tchaikovsky's ballet on the film with Australian ballet principal artist Dimity Azouri. In part two, we continue our look at this incredibly important and influential film in the Disney canon. Each episode in Ink and Paint, I'm joined by a special guest, not just film and animation enthusiasts, but people from all different professions. This week, I'm joined by Melbourne-based theatre director Stephen Nicolazzo. Stephen is the artistic director and founder of Little Ones Theatre, an independent theatre company focused on innovative queer and culturally and linguistically diverse theatre making. He is a Green Room Award winner for Best Direction on The Happy Prince and has been nominated a further three times. His directing credits also include Loaded for Malthouse Theatre, Daddy for Arts Centre Melbourne, Urimboy and Arts House, End Of for Darabin Arts Speakeasy, Merciless Gods for Arts Centre Melbourne and Griffin Theatre Company, Abigail's Party for Melbourne Theatre Company, Suddenly Last Summer and The Moors for Red Stitch, Dracula for Theatre Works, and Dangerous Liaisons for MTC Neon. Stephen, welcome to Ink and Paint.
Thanks for having me.
To begin with, Stephen, just for our listeners, talk to us a bit about the kind of work that you make and, you know, the kind of principles that have led you to, you know, the kind of themes and ideas that you explore with the work that you make.
Well, I guess first and foremost, my practice was focused on queer theatre and developing kind of bold and brash sort of aesthetic worlds to talk about marginalised voices. In the most recent years, I guess I've been looking more at the intersection between race and queerness and how that can manifest in the form of, say, something like Merciless Gods, which was a series of monologues and scenes based on Christos Tsolkas' novel, and then something like Daddy with Joel Bray, which is a dance work that incorporates storytelling and sort of visual Rococo imagery to explore First Nations voices. So I guess for me, I'm at a point where the visual worlds that I've been creating, you know, that are mostly influenced by camp aesthetics from Charles Ludlum in the 1960s to the cinema of like Pedro Almodovar or Ken Russell, that's sort of where I sit. And I think that the main thing that I'm interested in is, and I think we've talked about this before, is how image can tell story. And if you turn the volume down on one of my works, I hope that the bodies in the space and the way that the pictures are built can actually convey narrative.
And what led you to that idea of exploring telling a story through visual and movement as opposed to telling it through dialogue? How did you come to that as an aesthetic pursuit?
Originally, it was because I find language and dialogue in theatre, like capital T theatre, quite difficult to penetrate. And so I was kind of thinking of ways that could, I guess the first instance was, I was like, how do you create a close-up that you would create in a film on stage? That's where it began, like that question. And so I kept thinking about how you could then create the wide shot and the mise-en-scene and kind of all the detail that you would find in a beautiful cinematic shot, and how you could actually bring that to life on stage so that every single person on the stage, whether they're speaking or not, is activated, and so that there is, for an audience, you can kind of, like you would look at a film shot, you can kind of pick out bits and details that might be surprising that also might lend itself to further deepening the meaning of the scene. So I guess that's where it came from.
Which is a very exciting approach because, I mean, most people don't assume that there can be any kind of conversation between theatre and cinema as art forms. But it is one of the things that's really exciting about watching your work is that, you know, for me, someone who loves cinema, is to see the influence of cinematic language on stage as a living, breathing thing as opposed to a thing on a screen that's at a distance.
Yes, like it's kind of, there's something I find really pleasurable about seeing the cinematic technique in 3D. So it's not a screen. Like, you know, I really don't like it when there's screen work in shows sometimes because I feel like it's attempting the cinematic but not actually using the liveness as a means to do that. Because I think that the key to it really is light, which is what I love about Sleeping Beauty, which we'll get to later. But like the way that you can create a cinematic theatrical world is absolutely through the way that you position light on the body.
And with the principles of camp that you were talking about before, what makes a work a camp work or a queer work? What are some of the things that, you know, what are some of the things that you are drawn towards in creating a work that you would classify as camp or queer?
I guess with camp in itself, it's about extremities. And so things can be heightened to an otherworldly place but still talk about human issues. So I find what's really great about camp is that it operates on an operatic level. So you can go into melodrama or farce or to a gesture that is sort of pushed to its limits, and it can say something deeply heartbreaking or amusing. And I always think of Charles Ludlam's Ridiculous Theatre Manifesto when I think about camp. So he talks about kind of like the power of pathos and bathos, and how you should treat the serious with irreverence, and you should treat comedy with the essence of tragedy. And that's what I think, that's my kind of take on what camp can be. I think that it's not limited to caricature or style over substance, which is, you know, a criticism that has always been thrown at me. Because I actually think that the image itself is the depth, and the artifice that you're presenting is talking about the internal or the kind of subtextual worlds. That's what I really love about camp. You know, like Pedro Almodovar's early work, like Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown or Dark Habits, like they're extreme and they live in the world of farce and convoluted plot, but they actually are talking about something, I don't know, like quite emotional. So that's my take on camp. But queerness, I think, is a formal thing. And also, like, you know, a queer theatre piece is also looking at ways and approaches to the world that you don't see in sort of commercial or heteronormative stories. So it's always got to be about people who you do not see, who are never seen, who never get to speak.
Queer, you know, storytelling has expanded so much over the last, certainly over the last 10 years, but really over the last 5 years, it's really started to explode, particularly that idea of queerness is about something that isn't the heteronormative paradigm. But with camp, it seems to be a word that's thrown around a lot in relation to forms of television, forms of cinema, forms of fashion. Where do you, as someone who engages with the performativity of camp, where do you see it fitting now in like this point in the 21st century? What do we think, what we think of as camp speak to those original principles?
I'm not sure. Like, I suppose, and that's something that I'm exploring, is like, how do I take sort of the aesthetic principles and apply it to more humanist stories? So I'm not sure whether it has a place. Like, you look at, and I mean, please, I'm not trying to sound sacrilege, but like, you look at Ryan Murphy kind of, completely decimating the history of camp, you know, by kind of elevating it to a point where it becomes not ridiculous in a good way, but ridiculous in a completely convoluted and I don't know, like nonsensical way. I don't, like the references start to lose meaning completely, which is kind of interesting in terms of sort of a camp politic. But I don't know, it's lost its charm maybe in a kind of, if you think of things in a more accessible way, like in terms of the way that the word camp's thrown around. And it's making it a dirty word again, because that was the big thing for me. Like when I was studying, like that word was thrown at me like it was poison, and that it was something I should steer clear of completely, which I understand because, you know, it does limit your palate and all of that kind of thing. But yeah, making it a dirty word again is so, yeah, it's a bit disappointing because there's so much possibility in it as a form. Like I went to the Met last year, 2019, when we were still allowed to travel, and I saw the History of Camp exhibition and I wept because it was talking about it in terms of language, not just aesthetics. Like, you know, the verb to camp was first in a Molière farce. And so, and it kind of looked at the history of the fact that it's actually it's an action, and it's always had a theatrical birthplace. And the exhibition went through the history of it, like through Susan Sontag and all these imagery and collections of letters by Oscar Wilde and dresses by, you know, Schiaparelli. So for me, the way that camp can work now is if you honour the history and add your own bent to it. So like with Daddy, with Joel Bray, like we used really camp imagery, but to talk about colonization. So it's the way that you spin the iconography now that I think will bring it into the 21st century.
Because one of the things that I find so frustrating about the approach of camp in the 21st century, particularly with like through the prism of someone like Ryan Murphy, which I mean, I could talk about this for hours because I can't stand the man. But the idea, like, because camp is a form that was created as a at its peak when, you know, in the, you know, the civil rights movement for LGBTIQ+ people, camp was a revolutionary act. There was a political bent to it. It was it could be an act of anger. Now, through those kinds of lenses, now we look at camp and it's a confectionery. It's a form of just pure entertainment. It's just throw a bunch of pastel colours up, make a ridiculous image, and that's camp. It's like, well, no, that doesn't speak to the violence inherent in that artistic movement of trying to work against what the world wants, you know, art and entertainment and a human being to be. I can see that very much in what you and Joel did with Daddy, of just like there was a subversion of expectation of what these images and colours and textures should say to me.
There's anger and fury in camp, and that's what I like about it, because it's dark.
Yes, absolutely. And I mean, I guess that's a great way to kind of segue into talking about Disney, because I mean, there's a certain degree to which camp, and I think to a certain extent queerness and certainly the representation of the other, has become so much a part of the conversation around the kind of Disney canon and what it is that company and that art form produced. But my first question around Disney is, do you remember what the very first Disney animated classic was that you saw?
Yes, I believe it was Basil the Great Mouse Detective.
Did you watch it at the cinemas or did you watch it on VHS?
I think we bought it on VHS because I don't know why, but it was one that we had at home and I don't really remember it that well, other than the moment when they're at Big Ben and like the mouse is hanging from the clock. But that's the first one. And then the one that I remember the most, like having a deep effect on me, was Beauty and the Beast.
Yes, that one comes up quite a lot, particularly for anybody of kind of our generation. Beauty and the Beast, was that a VHS or was that at the cinema?
That was at the cinema, I think like 5 times.
Was Disney a big part of your household growing up? Was it something that you know, all enjoyed as a family, or were you kind of singular in your family and being drawn to it?
No, I think that my whole family enjoyed it. We also, like, I mean, my family was very interesting because we watched a lot of adult films as children. So Disney was kind of like the confection for, you know, when you wanted to watch something a little bit more innocent. Yeah, I think we really enjoyed it. My sister and I really loved Disney films, and I think the music of them as well.
And what about your relationship with Disney as you grew up? Because, you know, most people have that moment when they're a teenager where they kind of, you know, if they love Disney as a kid, they have that rebellious period where it's like, oh, no, fuck Disney. What was your relationship with Disney as, you know, as their films and as an art form as you were growing up into adulthood?
I never rebelled against it because I always admired the kind of technological advances of it and the beautiful imagery. I don't think I rebelled, but I think I was more interested in like the Pixar Disney stuff when I was a teenager. Like I really loved all of the Toy Story films, and I actually really liked it when they kind of had that resurgence into the older school animation style again. I can't remember what the films were. Oh, like, you know, like Emperor's New Groove and that kind of stuff, where it kind of went back to basics, I really enjoyed. So no, I don't think I ever really had a falling out with Disney.
Has Disney ever had any kind of effect on the work that you make? Like, can you look at any of the, you know, your theatre work and see any influences of Disney happening within that?
I don't think that it's Disney that influences it, but I think that the, and as I was looking at the references for Sleeping Beauty, I was like, I think the artistic movements that inspired those particular animation styles, like Expressionism or Art Nouveau or what was the Art Deco kind of, those definitely do. So I guess by proxy, yes, a lot of the imagery sticks. And actually, when I was watching Sleeping Beauty, there was a scene in it that looked exactly like a scene that I did in the Moors at Red Stitch. And I was like, maybe this is this weird subconscious camp history of a woman walking with a glowing light through a freaking hallway. And it's sort of, it's in everything. It's in Sleeping Beauty, it's in The Innocents, it's in The Others. It's bizarre. So that was quite interesting to kind of have a double take.
When Walt Disney put the studio's lavish adaptation of Sleeping Beauty into production at the beginning of the 1950s, he had intended for it to be the final word on their dominance in the field of animation. It would elevate the art form, embarrass their competitors, and offer something audiences had never seen before, an animated film on the scale of the great live-action widescreen epics of its time. By the beginning of 1958, though, the film had been in production for 6 years and was nowhere near completion, and in the process had lost two directors, Wilfred Jackson and Eric Larson, and its aesthetic leader, artist Ivan Earle. The film was bleeding money and resources, and though the work was impressive, there wasn't enough of it to get any strong impression of whether the film was actually working. As production dragged on and continued to go over budget at an alarming rate, Walt Disney Productions was once again edging towards the same state of financial risk that had defined their first two decades of production. If Sleeping Beauty failed, it wouldn't be their greatest feature-length animated film. It would be their last. In the midst of the chaos, though, small miracles were occurring on Sleeping Beauty. As well as pushing the art direction to its limits, the production prompted a dramatic evolution in other areas of animation and filmmaking, and secured the film's important legacy in the history of cinema. So, do you remember the first time you would have seen Sleeping Beauty? Do you have any memories of the first time you would have seen it?
Yeah, I reckon it was probably, I would have been very young, because as soon as I turned it on whilst rewatching it, the songs, the music all came back to me very, very quickly, because I think that it was one of those films that was sort of, I don't think the narrative ever stuck with me at all, but it was more, again, the kind of the imagery and the music, and especially that Tchaikovsky, the ballet soundtrack. That's what I remember vividly as a kid. So yeah, I think I've had a long relationship with it, but I've never revisited it because I always thought that it was a weak plot.
Which, I mean, it kind of does. Like, this is something we'll talk about a bit later, but like, you know, talking about, you know, it's not a film that grabs you with in terms of its narrative, and what you're left with is mostly just the sense of watching it and the, you know, the kind of images and colors and sounds of it. But it kind of does have a weak plot. I mean, it's barely an hour long. The characters, the primary characters are basically secondary characters. Like, you know, you have the stories mainly told from the supporting characters. But in a kind of unexpected way, that makes it feel even closer to a fairy tale than Snow White or Cinderella or Beauty and the Beast or any of the or Little Mermaid. They're so full of action and detail and character and dialogue. And you come to this, which has this, it's an enormous canvas and this very kind of primal feeling fairy tale and a very primal approach to it to go, here is the basic points of the plot and we're going to fill it in with just the world of this thing.
Yeah, and that's kind of exciting when you revisit it because actually that's the more enticing part of it. And I guess maybe the simplicity does work because they haven't tried to, you know, I mean, the ending is like, you know, the dragon, bloody lady and all that kind of stuff feels invented for the Disney market. But they haven't tried too hard to move away from the original story, which is kind of surprising for Disney.
And what was your response watching it now? First of all, from an audience perspective, we'll talk about your response as a storyteller and a theatre maker in a moment, but watching it now as an audience member, what was your response to revisiting it? Yeah, now.
It was a long 70 minutes as an audience member. I was like, this feels very drawn out and irritating. But I also thought it was quite funny. I thought that the character, the blue fairy, the kind of tubby short one, was like really hilarious. And I loved those characters a lot. That's probably my big takeaway, is that I had forgotten that the three fairies are actually the main storytellers and they were really entertaining to me. And I actually thought that they had such a cool emotional arc and stuff, and that was really fun. I guess what surprised me was how much I disliked Aurora and the Prince. I found them so dull that I couldn't connect with them, which was really difficult. I was like, shouldn't I care about these people? I guess not. Yeah, I think it was an interesting view. I don't think I was as thrilled by it as an adult now rewatching it as maybe I was as a child, but I thought artistically that it was very exciting.
It's a fair comment though, because I mean, Aurora, it's the funny thing is you think about, you know, Aurora and Philip barely say anything in this film. The surprising thing is that Philip says more in this film than any other Disney prince before him. And I think almost any Disney prince going forward, because realistically, you can have something like Eric. Eric doesn't really say much in The Little Mermaid. He just kind of stands around, looks hot. And the Beast is not really a prince until the very end where he says people's names as they transform out of being household objects. But Philip has he has a relationship with his horse, like he's doing stuff, he has action, and yet he still feels inadequate. Even though they're probably, it's the most, you know, in the last episode we were talking about how it's one of the more developed relationships between a Disney princess and a Disney prince, and it's still incredibly quick and incredibly fleeting, and you barely spend any time with them in the film. I guess you kind of already answered the question of do you think that is to the film's benefit or to its detriment that we don't have an emotional connection with our protagonists?
I don't know if it's to its detriment, but I guess I get what they're doing. And I think that it's good that they kind of make the matinee idol style prince a little bit more three-dimensional and have a drive or some sort of will. But I don't know, I guess the issue is again, with all of these stories, which is not necessarily just Disney's fault, but also the folk tales themselves, is that, you know, that there's this notion of true love being you look at someone or you hear them singing in some vibrato and then suddenly it's on. That's what I think is to the detriment of the work.
Yes, it does, which I guess, you know, the fact that Sleeping Beauty has such a stripped back narrative and there's not as much dialogue as in, say, something like Cinderella, it kind of works a little bit better in Sleeping Beauty because everything else is so, to the point. There's not a lot of, faff or business in this film. Where a film like Cinderella, the fact that there is no, development of the relationship between the romantic leads does make it kind of feel like you've been cheated of something, or makes it feel like a ridiculous ideal that doesn't mean anything, that, you know, there's not much to discern from the question of love and relationship and connection from a film like certainly Cinderella and definitely Snow White. This, because everything is so stripped back, it kind of works. It kind of falls into the kind of, you know, primal, foundational idea about what a fairy tale can do.
Yes, and also what's cool is there's some sort of, like, the scene where they, you know, meet in the woods and she just sort of, like, rests her head on his shoulder. I was like, this is quite erotic for a young person's film. And I quite appreciated that, like, that there's this sort of subtle reference to kind of, like, the sexual connection and how, like, there's a kind of a frisson that happens between people. That, like you say, is primal or more carnal. And I quite like that energy to it. And I think, like you said, like the stripped back nature of it really heightens those moments, which again means you don't need the dialogue for them to have a connection, which is kind of cool.
And there's also like, it's also, there's a physical exchange between them. I mean, Snow White and the Prince literally never, like they're never even within the same frame together in Snow White. And with Cinderella and the Prince, they have the dance, but they don't say a bloody word. They just do the dance. But there's a physical exchange between Philip and Aurora. She doesn't know, like, she's shocked because she's like, holy fuck, my dreams just walked into the glen with me and I don't know how to feel. It's lovely that she doesn't know how to feel about it, that she's just like, no, this, that's an ideal. I've talked about how, like, you know, I met this guy in a dream and, you know, he's probably my true love. And then he walks into the glen and it's just like, no, that's not the way this is supposed to work. That's a dream. This is reality. I don't like this. And that you have to watch the physical exchange of him very quickly, you know, in the course of maybe 30 seconds, him having to gain her trust, her being physically comfortable with one another, and it kind of culminates in them being able to dance together. That there is a much more of a physical connection between these romantic leads as opposed to just an idealized fairy tale confectionery version, like idea about how two people can form an emotional connection, a romantic emotional connection.
That's true, actually. And also there's something then satisfying when they kiss at the end and he wakes her, because you have seen history between them. And like the look in her eyes when she recognises that it's him is actually quite satisfying.
And not as problematic as, you know, Snow White being awoken by the prince in that film, where it's like you literally have no relationship. All the prince has done is just sit there, sung a song from the other side of a wall, and then turns up on his white horse and goes, oh, that's a pretty girl, I'll kiss her. You can feel, and also the fact that unlike any other Disney prince up until this point, and there's only been three, there's only, you know, the prince in Snow White and Cinderella and then Sleeping Beauty, Philip actually does something in order to earn the right to be able to have a connection with Aurora. He fights a dragon. He, you know, battles through a forest of thorns. He's not a complacent romantic lead. He's actually an active part of the narrative. And what he's asked to do in order to be an active part of the narrative is not it's not a small thing. He's fighting a fucking giant dragon that's, you know, spewing fire at him and fighting through a forest of thorns to get to her. Like, at least when he gets to her, they have a connection. They have met before. There is a frisson between them, and he's proven that he actually wants to be there, that he cares enough that he wants to save this girl from a fate of sleeping forever until someone else comes along. There's just the tiniest bit more substance to this relationship that makes it slightly less uncomfortable within the context of our understanding of the way that relationships and emotional connection works.
Yeah, I would agree with that. You've kind of turned me around on it. There's something good, like, you know, he's been chained up by this, like, wicked woman in this, like, sexy dungeon and, like, you know, he's disturbed by it and I don't know. Like, he's put through, I guess he's put through, like, that kind of very cliche, like, hero's journey. Like, he has to actually overcome obstacles to be able to not win the prize, but to actually, like you say, connect with this woman. And with the help of three women as well, like he's like the three fairies help him. Like, it's not just led by this man, this young guy. Like, everything is kind of situated between the experiences of women, which I thought was quite interesting as well.
Well, I was going to ask, as someone who's made a lot of works around the relationships between women, the role of women within a narrative, the role of women within society, not just, you know, heterosexual, you know, women, but also women of colour and queer women. How do you see the representation of women within this film? Because it is a film predominantly told with female characters and active female characters.
Yeah, I was surprised actually that it was so populated by female voices. And I thought that was a good thing, particularly like the kind of, yeah, these three, I guess they're matriarchs in the guise of fairies, and then this complex evil, I put in inverted commas, woman who just seems like someone who's actually just pissed off about a kind of history that we don't really understand, or, you know, there's something complex about the villain. And then Aurora is also complex in the sense that she has a kind of erratic response to this prince and then is sort of devastated by it. But it doesn't feel like it's necessarily a narrative that's against the kind of female agency, because actually you're positioned into a spot where you're rooting for all of the women and you're also respecting the prince. So it's kind of even playing field, which I thought was quite good and very different to a lot of the other pieces in their canon.
And also that Aurora isn't a gooey-eyed princess. Like, she's, it was something we were talking about in the last episode where, you know, you look at someone like Snow White and she has such a childlike innocence to her, and Cinderella feels like she's probably in her late teens and she's had a very, very difficult life, but she has that kind of youthful optimism. Aurora walks on and you don't, it's kind of a surprise to remember that she's 16 years old because she feels so grounded. There's such a gravity to her presence within the film, but also that her response to all of these kind of idealized ideas of what you think a princess wants, to be a princess, which she doesn't know that she is, to live in a giant castle, to marry a prince, to have everything that she, you know, everything that her heart could desire at her fingertips, her response is to be overwhelmed, devastated, and frightened. Like, that's what she's, you know, of course she's upset that, you know, she's likes this man wandering in the woods and she's been told she has to marry somebody else. But it's also the thing of, she walks in on her 16th birthday and is told by these three women that she's trusted, that she's believed her entire life, have her back, and gone, you're not Briar Rose, you're Princess Aurora. Your parents are waiting for you. It's your 16th birthday. Tonight you will marry somebody that you've never met. You're a princess and you live in a castle, not in a cottage in the woods with three aunts to take care of you. And the whole time, her every response to this is just, this isn't what I want. This is not the life that I thought I was going to have. In that brief moment with Philip in the woods where she goes, oh, this might be the person I spend my life with because that's the way that a fairy tale works. And she starts to see the possibility of, you know, of this person and a life with this person. And that's ripped away from her at that last second. She's like, I don't want any of this. I want that human connection. And I mean, you know, the smile she has on her face when she wakes up is that kind of recognition of, ah, okay, this might be all right. This might not be the nightmare that I think it is.
Yeah, that's true. Like, I love the expression on her face when she opens her eyes, because it's not that kind of gushy, like, oh, my hero. It's like a, oh, I'm at peace, which I thought was quite beautiful. And I think the expectation of, I think she just wanted not average life, but she didn't have aspirations more than just to meet someone, because she's been stuck in the woods with these three women her entire life. And it doesn't necessarily mean that it had to be romantic either. Like, I think that's what's kind of interesting about it. It's just to see and meet another human.
Yeah, absolutely. You get the impression with both Snow White and Cinderella that there is a life that they have lived. Certainly Cinderella, because of the amount of domestic abuse that happens in that film towards her from her family. But with Aurora, you definitely feel the sense of this is a person that has lived a life that they know, that they feel comfortable with, that they embrace and they enjoy, that like she feels like she's lived in the world. And the idea of this decision coming through to, you know, the realization of I'm not who I thought I was, you can feel such a titanic shift in her. And then the way that, you know, Aurora and Philip walk down the stairs at the end of the film, where it's not like there's not a formality to it. There's a warmth to their connection. There's a warmth to the idea of, you know, that as they walk down the stairs, they look at each other. They don't have to, you know, go into a big dance and sing a song about how much they love each other or make big proclamations of their affection. They just kind of have to hold each other's hands and walk down the stairs and look at each other and go, hey, that's really cool. You're actually the person that I wanted. You're not this idea of a partner which has been pushed on top of me from when I was a child in Philip's case, or yesterday in the case of Aurora. It's a thing of, oh no, you're my person and I get to do this with you, and that's what's going to make this worth it. I hadn't even thought about it that deeply, you know, the intricacies of their relationship.
But there is something like, you know, that she conjures him, like, you know, that she creates him, that she leads that fantasy that becomes a reality. But I think that there is something in that. There is maybe some, I mean, we're just reading into it and kind of applying, you know, some sort of framework for reading it. But I don't know. There is something cool about that, I think.
Tiny princess, my gift shall be the gift of song.
As well as medieval and Gothic art, another major influence on Sleeping Beauty was the beloved ballet, composed by Peter Ilyich Tchaikovsky and first performed in 1890. At first, it was treated simply as source material, but the ballet would quickly become part of the fabric of the film itself. In 1952, Sammy Fain and Jack Lawrence were contracted to write the songs for the film, after the successful work Fain had done for Alice in Wonderland and Peter Pan. They wrote a full suite of songs to accompany the story treatment being prepared, but a year later, Walt began to worry that a traditional Disney song score wouldn't match with the visual language Ivan Earle was developing. Not only did Sleeping Beauty need to look different, it needed to sound different. Walt decided that the film would use Tchaikovsky's ballet as its score, adapted to fit their needs. All of Fain and Lawrence's songs were rejected, with the exception of Once Upon a Dream, which had used the waltz from Act 1 of the ballet as the basis for its melody. At first, Walter Schumann was given the task of adapting the ballet, but he soon quit over creative differences with Walt. Instead, the job of turning the beloved ballet into a full symphonic score was given to composer George Bruns. Bruns had joined the studio as an arranger in 1953. He had never attempted anything of the scale of Sleeping Beauty before, but had been recommended for the job by Ward Kimball. It would have been much easier to write an original score, he said in 1958, but the ballet is rich in melody, as much as Tchaikovsky is. It was a matter of choosing which melodies to use. His adaptation of the ballet took 3 years to complete, balancing it with his work for the Davy Crockett series on the Disneyland TV show. Almost every moment of the Sleeping Beauty score was extracted from the ballet, with Bruns filling in the musical gaps when necessary. In addition to Once Upon a Dream, a number of other songs were added to the score, once again using music from the ballet arranged by Bruns, with lyrics by Tom Adair, Ed Penner, Winston Hibbler, and Ted Sears. When it came to the scene where King Stefan and King Hubert drink together, Bruns couldn't find an appropriate melody for the ballet, so Scump's Drinking Songs is the only song in the film not rooted in Tchaikovsky. The most important principle in Bruns' score, though, was that any new material must always sound like Tchaikovsky, so that the score would be as holistic as the visuals. When it came time to record Bruns' completed score, Walt made another major technical decision. To match the scope of the Super Technorama 70mm image, the film needed to be recorded in 4-track stereo sound and released in 6-track stereo. He had made a similar bold decision with Fantasia in 1940, but despite the fact that the cost of Fantasound had been one of the reasons for the film's box office failure, he was sure this would add value to Sleeping Beauty for the public. The vocal performances were recorded in Los Angeles, but when musicians in the city began to strike, they were forced to look elsewhere to record the score, settling on a new state-of-the-art recording facility in Berlin. George Bruns' score for Sleeping Beauty was recorded with the Grand Symphony Orchestra, with Bruns conducting between September 8th and November 25th, 1958. When the digital restoration of the film was undertaken for its 50th anniversary in 2009, the complete original recording sessions were found in startling, pristine condition.
In the mid-50s, a lot of the separated elements were destroyed. They figured they'd never go back and remix the movie again. But when it came to Sleeping Beauty, I came across these elements and turned out to be the actual recording sessions straight off the floor from Germany.
MM
5215. False starts, bad takes, alternate versions, the whole full recording sessions. When I was listening to this stuff, it was just amazing. The recordings were so clean, and the noise floor was so low.
You could actually hear the clothes rustling as violins are bowing,
It's like you're at a concert.
In the booth overseeing the recording was Disneyland Records musical director Tutti Camerata. After hearing the clarity of the stereo recording, Camerata approached Walt with the idea of releasing Bruns' score as a commercial album. The studio had released the first commercial soundtrack with Snow White and the Seven Dwarves in 1937, but that had only featured the songs. The soundtrack for Sleeping Beauty would be the first ever commercial release of an orchestral film score, and the first true stereo soundtrack for an animated film. While much praise is heaped upon Ivan's Earl extraordinary visual design, George Bruns' score for Sleeping Beauty is equally as triumphant, one that was recognised with both an Oscar and a Grammy nomination. It still stands as one of the best scores in the Disney canon, and one of the greatest communions between visual and music in any film. So one of the things that's spoken about the most, actually probably the thing that is spoken about the most with this film, is the way that it looks. It's, you know, whenever you talk to anyone talks about this film, it's always, it's the most beautiful Disney animated film. Maybe the most beautiful animated film ever made, possibly. So, I mean, it's that, and it's that thing, if you know, we were talking about before, of the idea that it emphasizes storytelling through aesthetic as opposed to storytelling through dialogue, which is something that you have also explored in your work. What are some of the kind of approaches that one has to take in order to tell a story in a visual sense as opposed to a narrative or dialogue-driven sense? And how successfully does this film do it?
Well, I think the thing that this film does successfully in terms of that is it's specific. And as you said before, you used the word kind of like streamlined in terms of its narrative. So every symbol or image that's applied in a shot is rich with meaning immediately because the image is sort of building, I guess, your emotional response to the story. So, you know, the one that I keep thinking about that I think I sent you an email like randomly going, it's got such a hallucinatory quality, is when their three fairies are kind of dreaming up the future for this young girl, and there's all these beautiful kind of like montages of images and layering of like rose petals or that look really trippy, like everything kind of looks surreal. I keep thinking about that in terms of how it kind of builds a magical universe without kind of going for the typical I guess cliches of that, like, you know, that the flower opens and she's in it or whatever. Like, it doesn't do that. It kind of just layers these beautiful colors over her face, so you get, it's evocative rather than obvious. Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely. And also that is something that's so unusual within Disney animation, certainly up until that point, and really kind of in general. Like, the moment of you know, the three gifts that the fairies give, but also the moment where Maleficent tells Philip what the future is going to be, that you're going to be stuck here for 100 years and you're going to leave and you're going to, as an old man, and you're going to find, and the images are entirely abstract and deeply cinematic. I think that's the thing that is really shocking. Like, watching, it's one of the things that's been really great doing this project is watching the films chronologically. And so you're seeing the development of the language of Disney animation. But watching this after Lady and the Tramp, and this is a film that I have watched hundreds of times. I know every frame of this film, but watching it in the context of having just watched Lady and the Tramp, it was kind of jaw-dropping to see a film that completely changes the language of what we think animation can do. Because, I mean, the animation to a certain extent is, you know, in its laziest form, and sometimes Disney can be accused of this, is reaching towards reality. The idea of this is an art form that human beings create with their hands, a pencil to a piece of paper that then has a sense of movement. And in its laziest form is trying to reach a sense of reality, like trying to imitate what the real world, a live action film can do. Sleeping Beauty is a film that completely embraces something that only animation could do, but also something that only cinema could do. I mean, there are sequences in Sleeping Beauty that could be compared to sequences in Vertigo. Like, there's, you know, the hallucinatory dreamlike state.
I would absolutely agree with that. There's also, like, it's those incredible shots of Aurora being brought to this, the the deep, dark recesses of the castle by Maleficent to the spindle. And that green hue, like just like that, and every shot is kind of like in a wide frame where just a little bit of light in the corner and her body floating through the space. And there's no dialogue whatsoever except for the kind of like echoes of the fairies. Like, it's also very theatrical, which I suppose in relation to your question about, you know, how do you sort of approach visual storytelling? It's emotional. Like, you don't have to say it to feel it. Like, it's the way that the light hits her. It's the way that space is kind of vacuous and we don't know where she's going. That really tells us that we should fear for her and that, you know, there's a vulnerability to her without her having to go, oh, my God, I'm lost, or, you know, having to telegraph the fact that she's under this spell. Does that make sense? Like, I feel like there's something really exciting about an image doing all of that for you in relation to music as well, but that you can just sit with you and you can feel the fear.
Yes, absolutely. And also it makes the film feel deeply psychological. The themes and ideas and that are being explored in the film, and that's a very, like, reductive way to kind of talk, like, you know, themes and ideas, but, like, you know, you get the sense of a psychological subtext to this film, which in some ways is more exciting than any dialogue could ever give it. It's why, like, there's a great psychological subtext to Fantasia, even though Fantasia doesn't have a narrative of any kind, or one of the reasons why Pinocchio is such a powerful film, because there's so much psychological space and subtext in that film. With this one, the language of what you're seeing, you're not necessarily always seeing what the characters are seeing. You're kind of seeing what the characters are feeling. It's a film that's driven by an emotional, psychological response as opposed to a narrative one. So, you know, even just like the way that, particularly like that sequence where Aurora is being drawn to the spinning wheel, you know, you even have the music is starting to become part of the rhythm and action, the rhythm of the action. Like, all of a sudden you can feel this great conversation happening between what George Bruns is doing with Tchaikovsky's score and what the visual language is doing. Even the way the camera moves, the positioning of, you know, where a character is in a frame. There's a degree of thought put into this film that's really surprising, considering what we think of as Disney animation, where, you know, obviously there's thought put into every single frame of a Disney animated film, but not to the extent where, you know, it's kind of like the stereotypical thing that is said about this film. You could put any single frame of this film on a wall and it would be you could call it a work of art. There's not a single frame in this film that they haven't taken advantage of every single, like, square centimeter of what is in the frame.
No, even the way that the body's moving in and out of shadow is extraordinary. Like, the way that the sharp line of the shadow goes across the face and then across the arms, like, everything is detailed and stunning. And I also think that, like, as you were saying about the subtext of all these images, is there's a kind of roaring eroticism to it that feels really adult and it feels haunted. Like, the whole thing feels like a nightmare, like, as opposed to so many of the other fairy tales where, you know, the happy, like, the lighting is, like, quite bright and everything's very sweet and warm. Actually, even the scenes where she's okay or where there's something there's some moment of frivolity, there's always an edge in the film, which I think is really brilliant ways, it's a brilliant way of expressing the subtext visually, again, without dialogue. There's always threat.
It's threat represented by a character that is kind of the ultimate image of threat. You know, Maleficent, you know, the first you see Maleficent in silhouette before you see her face. Like, when she appears in, you know, at the christening, you see the horns, you see the cape, you see the form, you see the staff, and then you see her face. It's the last thing that you're given. And the minute she appears on screen, you know exactly who this woman is. You know exactly what she represents within this film, and you know that she is a considerable threat. Not, you know, I can't, like, in a way, you know, you've got someone like Lady Tremaine in Cinderella, or Captain Hook, or, you know, where they're kind of they're threats within our understanding of the real world because they have real human actions and responses, slightly heightened, but they feel human. Maleficent doesn't feel human. She feels pure. She feels like she was literally born from the ground itself, that she just appeared as, like, the, you know, the primal concept of evil and fury, and there's no way you can get around. I mean, realistically, her motivation is, you didn't invite me to the christening, I'm pissed off, I'm going to hold a grudge for 16 years, and I will sleep well when this girl is dead. And that's it. And the in a way is, not the most complex of character motivations, but the power of her is that it's pure. And you know that that's all she cares about. And I will just destroy all of your lives because you insulted me.
Yeah, and pride is is a big part of the story for her. But talk about camp, in terms of Maleficent, my God. And I was reading that the image of her was inspired by, I think, a Russian artist.
Czechoslovakian art.
Czechoslovakian, that's right. And is quite, they wanted it to be a representation of pure evil. And I was like, funny that the representation of pure evil dresses fabulously, has great colour palettes, has the most ridiculous voice I've ever heard. It's quite straight. I kind of love the weird queer otherness of her because she, like you say, I like that she's got a one-track mind. She's just like, well, you didn't invite me and therefore you die, which is quite extraordinary and ridiculous. And I guess that's kind of why she, like Ursula or even the wicked stepmother in Cinderella and Captain Hook, they have become kind of queer icons or camp icons because they're all quite feminine and quite strange, which I find really interesting, especially in terms of design as opposed to just performance,
They're also marginalized. And I think that's a really important thing about Maleficent is that she's a character that's been, if we meet the three good fairies, we meet Fauna, Flora and Merryweather, and we instantly go, oh, they're lovely because they look like the Golden Girls and so we feel comfortable with them. But then Maleficent turns up and we're told this is also a fairy, and she lives in the Forbidden Mountains by herself with all of her goblins. She's marginalized but powerful. She's, an other that has great influence over everybody else and kind of leads the conflict and tension of the story. Because, I mean, it's something I've also want. It's one thing I want to look into at some point in this giant project of the queerness of the Disney villains, because it's kind of they weirdly become, the next Disney villain is Cruella de Vil, who's probably the most queer icon, villain icon of them all. But why is it that LGBTIQ community, and artists are drawn to the villains more than the heroes? I mean, also they're more interesting. I mean, Maleficent is significantly more interesting than Aurora.
Yeah, and also I think it's because, again, they aren't recognisable, they are othered, they are all of the things that you can kind of relate to, and they have a really good time being cruel and delicious and dangerous. And I think that the danger is part of the attraction. That's why I think, someone like Divine is such an amazing figurehead for, and was used as a model for Ursula, because drag queens or queer imagery is so, it's not grotesque, but there is an element of that in there that makes that community feel safer or represented in a kind of disturbing but also pleasurable way. All the iconography around Maleficent and her castle is quite S&M, all of the chains and the darkness and it's basically she's wearing leather. Does that make sense? They're kind of icons of a dirty, dirty secret world, which I think is why as a young kid you're sometimes like, oh, I wonder what's going on there. And there's a curiosity about them.
And also the fact that she enjoys it. There's pleasure in her causing of pain. I mean, that's another reason why she's so frightening, is because you know that she's going to lock Philip up for 100 years and she's going to enjoy every single second of it. The way that Lady Tremaine, the stepmother in Cinderella, you know she enjoys every single terrible thing that she does to Cinderella, and that's why she's frightening. And, you have cartoon villains like Captain Hook, which is just, I just want to kill the kid because he stole my hand and fed it to a crocodile. But there's no pleasure in what Captain Hook is doing. He's just got a vendetta and he wants to complete it. There's real pleasure for Maleficent in this. There's real pleasure in knowing, I'm going to piss off this king and queen, I'm going to piss off these three fairies, and I'm going to kill this girl. And in the process, I'm going to ruin this young man's life. And he's just going to be locked in my dungeon forever.
Yeah, and that's hot for her. I think what's interesting with these villains and someone like Maleficent is that they're childless, and that I think that there's something that as a queer person, I always related to the villains in that regard, because I was like, oh, you don't have to have a child. You don't have to have this family. You don't have to have this like kind of fairy tale life. You can actually be this fabulous creature who's just like, I don't give a shit what you think. And that's kind of what I like about her. But like, and she has that extraordinary, that line I think you mentioned before where, you know, she's like, well, I will sleep well tonight, darling, you know, like to her bird. And I was like, oh my God, it's Mrs. Venable from Tennessee Williams Suddenly Last Summer, like saying, I have my 5 o'clock daiquiri. Like, it's these extraordinary othered women who, or creatures, I should say, I don't think that they're necessarily gendered, like Captain Hook too, like that they're just, they really don't want to be a part of, to quote Ariel, they don't want to be part of our world. They want to be part of another world. And I think that that's what's really exciting about her as a character. And also visually, like, I think that's like the first Disney villain that feels like absolutely out of this world visually, and kind of the way that she moves and the design feels incredibly unique and really original for the company to this point, I would say.
Forest of thorns shall be his tomb. Born through the skies on a fog of doom. Now go with a curse and serve me well. Round Stefan's castle, cast my spell.
Of all the remarkable sequences in Sleeping Beauty, none are as astonishing as the final battle between Prince Philip and Maleficent. A perfect storm of everything that is great about the film, it demonstrates the apotheosis of its pursuit for perfection. The sequence was a collaboration between supervising director Clyde Geronimi and directing animator Wolfgang Reitherman, who joined Geronimi on the sequence after he had taken over the film from Eric Larson. Later asked about the sequence, Reitherman, who would go on to direct many of the Disney animated features in the 1970s, said, "We took the approach that we were going to kill that damn prince."
I know when I first showed it, some of the guys criticized, well, how'd the prince get up there and all those things? But Walt liked it because it kept driving all the time. I think one of the things that was interesting to me, all through that sequence, I tried to get everybody to think that the prince was going to get killed. We didn't, you know, theoretically, we didn't know. In other words, you were driving to kill that prince all the way through. But that's what I mean, is that it progresses and builds and builds and builds in excitement until man, it. If you haven't got anywhere else to go, then stop it. Stop it right there and do the killing.
The sequence would be Reitherman's greatest achievement, taking the visceral drama of Ivan Earle's concept art and matching it to the raw fury of George Bruns's score. To ensure that the music and animation were in harmony, a full orchestral recording of the track was completed before work on the animation began, so that Reitherman, Geronimi and the team could work off the rhythms and timing in Bruns's score. In Vulture's 2020 article, listing the 100 most influential sequences in animation, which included the dragon battle in Sleeping Beauty, they wrote, "Philip's galloping horse and Maleficent's transformation are clear images of good and evil that are immediately understood and brought to a thrilling conclusion of explosive greens, twisting brambles, and the deadly fires of hell. The sequence is regarded as one of the greatest in any animated film. It has also been cited numerous times as a landmark not just in animation, but in 70mm filmmaking. And in 2008, Oscar-winning filmmaker Guillermo del Toro listed Maleficent in dragon form as one of the greatest screen dragons, a triumph of elegance, of colour and design. One thing I wanted to kind of talk about was the influence of the Gothic in this film, because there is a certain degree of the Gothic in some of the works that you have done. What impact does the Gothic have on this story, and how does it work to the benefit of this film, and possibly to its detriment if you think that it does so?
I think it is extraordinarily effective in this film because it's a medieval story, and I think that I was reading as well that some of the original animators, like, or conceptual artists on the work, brought these old tapestries to Disney to show them a potential stylistic approach to the work that were these Gothic cathedrals, and so, which is amazing. And I think the way it's lit always gives it a Gothic feel. And I think that as a genre, it feels right for Sleeping Beauty because, again, there's menace in the story, and a Gothic world always has this kind of sense of darkness and shadow. And the way that they play with it is really interesting because they use vibrant colours to get to pique our kind of emotional interest and start to invest in moments, and then they take it away with like a green or like a hue that's really unearthly, and that's really beautiful to see in terms of genre. And I think that it makes it heightens the stakes as well when you put it into a Gothic space. And I guess the reason why, like, I often apply it because I also think that Gothic art and Gothic cinema or literature is part of a camp canon, and a visual aesthetic that feels like it's inherently about othered or marginalized experiences, because again, it sits in darkness. And so I do think that the film is really successful at actually creating a world that's in combat with the darkness of Maleficent and the kind of lightness of Aurora's story, but always lets the shadows into both.
We think about Gothic art in relation to this film, which we think about it as like an artistic influence, but you're right. It's not like there's a difference between like the artistic influence of Gothic, like putting a Gothic aesthetic over a film, you know, the straight lines, the medieval art qualities, that everything is geometric, everything is within the same focus, there's nothing out of focus, that kind of thing. But by extension of that, the film itself is Gothic in a kind of a metatextual sense as well, that it's speaking to the principles of what we understand as Gothic storytelling. And that's funny. I don't think they were thinking of this as a piece of Gothic storytelling. They were just thinking about this as a piece of Gothic art, like Gothic-influenced art. Because if that's the last thing you'd ever think of to apply to a Disney animated film, certainly in the 50s, when you've just had films like Peter Pan and Alice in Wonderland and Cinderella, that you would apply something as ancient a concept as a Gothic sensibility to a story.
Yeah, I guess that's sort of related to the folkloric aspect to Sleeping Beauty, which some of those other stories don't necessarily have, which is kind of great, like, because its seed is of a period where things were dangerous, and the way that that oral histories or oral stories were told were those warnings, or, you know, they were familial recollections and that kind of thing. And I think that what I really like about the aesthetic world of Sleeping Beauty is that it feels, as you mentioned Hitchcock before, like it feels like Vertigo, it feels like Shadow of a Doubt, like that kind of like the innocent maiden in trouble by the dirty dark shadow world. And it feels really appropriate, and actually feels like the most genre-like of a Disney film that I've seen in a long time. Like, in, you know, like specifically in a particular style, and even the way that things unfold feels like something out of Rebecca or Wuthering Heights.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is, in a way, this is a film that makes it clear that there is no such thing as the Disney style, which is fascinating when you think about the making of the film, because they're talking like, you know, the artists are, you know, pushing against what Ivan Dirl is presenting them. Like, this is not what Disney is. This is kind of the proof that there is no such thing as a standard Disney style. This is a thing that has to kind of evolve depending on what story it is. This just happens to be the most extreme example of that. And, you know, the most extreme example of animation really embracing the language of the form that it's in, which is cinema. That it's going, how can animation do what cinema is doing? Even just the decision to have it in as wide a scope as it is. I mean, 2.55 to 1 is, I think, maybe the widest aspect ratio any film is capable of being in a traditional, you know, widescreen format. And, the, you know, it was funny because I watched this film a lot as a kid on VHS, so I always saw it in 4:3, the way that all of us did when we were kids. And then I remember the first time I saw it on DVD, a friend of mine bought the DVD, we watched it at his house, and I saw it in widescreen for the first time, and I gasped because I didn't realize there was like 30% of the picture missing. But what I also didn't realize at that point was that wasn't the whole image, because they hadn't done a restoration of the full Technorama image. So when they released it on Blu-ray, and so the version that's on Disney Plus, that's the full film. And you just look at it and you're like, that's insane.
It is so, and like you say, like, and that scope, like, there are shots in this film that I was like, this, these are extraordinary. Like, even just like a particular angle, like where Aurora kind of looks over and sees the prince, like the particular frame was stunning. Like, this is where she's placed in the shot. I was like, Jesus, this is, I find it really inspiring actually, because it makes you, again, go back to theatre, like, it makes me kind of think about ways that you can kind of position people in the mise-en-scene of a live space in the same way that shots in this film do, because it is so beautifully crafted.
And how important those decisions can be. I mean, it's like, you know, look, I think one of the crown jewel sequences of this film is when Aurora is walking up the staircase to, you know, prick her finger on the spinning wheel and fall asleep. And the way that she moves from one side of the frame to the other, the rhythm with which she moves from one side of the frame to the other, the way that, you know, the rhythm of the cuts to the fairies looking for her, even just the way that it repeats images that you have, you know, she'll be walking up a set of staircase where she's walking with this horrifying ethereal certainty, and then the next time you see that bit of staircase, the fairies are frantically flying up and trying to find her. And just the fact that every single moving thing, like, obviously this is any animated film has to do this, but so much thought has been put into the movement of every single thing within these frames to give you the ultimate maximum impact as an audience member, that you're watching that and you can't take your eyes off it.
Yes, and that, like, and that the action, like, the detail in their movement is actually the story, or is like, it's driving, as you say, the rhythm. And it's so exciting, like, every little moment, even, you know, when just the fact that, like, when the goblins are attacking them and the fairies are turning, like, you know, arrows into flower stems, and the bubble, like, boulders into bubbles, like, all these clever visual ways to kind of show the symbology of goodness and evil. It's beautiful and it feels really charged. I'm going on a rant because I actually, the more I talk about it, the more I love the visual world of it. And just like you say, the consideration of every frame and every symbol. Like, it's a semiotician's wet dream, this film.
And that kind of becomes, like, you know, I was thinking the same thing when I watched it again last night, like that moment where the arrows turn into flowers, and how beautiful an image that is, but how ancient an image that feels, and the way that it's framed, that, like, you know, even just things like, there's that shot, one of my favorite shots in the whole film, when Philip sees Maleficent in dragon form for the first time, and it's just his face. It's like a Dutch angle on his face. He's holding his shield. He looks fucking terrified. And the only movement that Philip does is he blinks once, but the lighting in that entire shot shifts to go, now he's fucked. Like, the tension of the, like, he's just gotten through the Forest of Thorns, but it's like that lighting shift just makes you go, the stakes of this film have just gone into the biblical. Like, now we're into something that is beyond human experience, because now this man who's trying to reach the woman he loves now has to fight the living embodiment of anger and fury and everything that he's fighting against. And all it is just a lighting shift. And then when you think about that, it's a lighting shift that is done by people painting onto a piece of plastic. The whole pursuit of this film was to reach perfection. I mean, that's the kind of narrative of Walt Disney's life as an artist and a storyteller, is trying to achieve unattainable perfection. The thing that's so incredible about Sleeping Beauty is it's the one film where you go, they kind of did it. And of course it cost them cost them so much emotionally, financially, physically, mentally to do it. It's the kind of the beauty and horror of Sleeping Beauty is that it is basically kind of a perfect object, and that to be perfect is not an easy thing, and it will always come at a cost. That there kind of has to be literal blood, sweat and tears in order to make something this monumental. And I mean, you know, we can sit here 60 years later and look at it and go, well, it was worth the effort. I sometimes wonder, like, do they, in 1960, when they're off working on 101 Dalmatians, are they looking at Sleeping Beauty and going, was that worth 7 years of my life? Breakdown of relationships, breakdown of my physical and mental health. Like, was that pursuit worth it? But what I was going to ask is this, you know, as an artist, do you think that it's worth it? Do you think that it's worth putting your mind and body and soul on the line for a work?
When I was younger, I definitely would answer yes straight away, because I do believe in that kind of rigor and obsession. And I think that if you can find a way to balance it, yes, it's worth it. And this is, I mean, again, it kind of comes to this, to the Disney mythology as well. It's like, I don't know, I guess you want to, as an artist, you want to have contributed something to the world, right? Like, whether that's the perfection of Sleeping Beauty or, you know, a piece of theatre that maybe stays with, you know, 50 people for the rest of their lives or more. I feel like that drive, like the passion for that is worth pursuing, even if it, sometimes if it means that sort of some relationships can, and your mental health can be put into precarious states. But I think as you get older, you learn how to balance that a little bit better. That's my personal opinion. Like, you can go, okay, for this, you know, next year, this is the one I'm going to think about. This is the one I'm going to pour my passion and my energy into. And you know, also, I guess, accept that not everybody's going to feel as passionate about it as you. That's a big one, I think, which is probably something Walt Disney never learned.
No, I don't think he ever did. No. I think the proof is in the pudding of this film, really.
Yeah. Evil, pure. He's Maleficent.
When production began on Sleeping Beauty, it became clear that the current Disney staff were not equipped to handle its enormous demands. For the first time since Snow White, a trainee program was instigated to find new assistant animators, and 15 assistant animators were promoted to animators. Despite some rare exceptions, the long-standing sexism towards women in animation still existed at Disney, with women usually only given opportunities outside of the ink and paint department under extreme circumstances. The demands of Sleeping Beauty meant that the supervising animators couldn't be so pedantic, and for the first time, a program was set up for women to train as assistant animators. The program was initially overseen by animator Johnny Bond. The female artists were put through their training with the option of additional night classes. From these participants, the most promising were hired as in-betweeners. As it turned out, the patience, skill, determination, empathy, and attention to detail of these female artists became an enormous asset on Sleeping Beauty. It was an animated motion picture perfectly suited to the unique sensibilities inherent in most women artists, said animator Floyd Norman in 2015, who had worked as an in-betweener on Sleeping Beauty and as the first African-American artist employed at the studio full-time. Male artists, frustrated with the drawings where the weight of an eyelash was considered important, often deferred to the skill and patience of their female colleagues. The film would also prove to be a masterpiece for the women in ink and paint. The extreme level of detail in the design and animation required even more meticulous work than they had attempted before, and though it took longer, the results were breathtaking. For the inkers in particular, the film showed them at the height of their craft, with the width of every line scrutinized and perfected. "Oh, they were amazing, those inkers," said assistant animator Jane Bayer in 2015. "The meticulous detail in the eyes of the character and every curl on the princess, it was something else." The necessities on Sleeping Beauty offered a long-needed opportunity for the women of Walt Disney Productions, and not only was it an opportunity they embraced, but one in which they excelled. There was a new energy to the work, a new perspective and texture that hadn't been there before. That energy would not last. The worst was yet to come. To kind of start wrapping up on talking about Sleeping Beauty, I mean, we could talk about it for literally all day, but to kind of wrap up on talking about it, obviously we've spoken a lot about how incredible the aesthetics of this film are and the pursuit of all the great things that come from the pursuit of perfection in the making of this film. How does that approach, though, cause the film to, in some respects, fall short? Do you think there are any shortcomings that this film suffers from because its emphasis on its aesthetic and that pursuit for perfection are the overriding drives for the making of the film?
I don't know. I'm probably the wrong person to ask that question because I've had that criticism of my own work about, you know, aesthetic or style being the driver. So I wouldn't criticize it for doing that. I think that that's a good thing. The shortcoming maybe is purely just, you know, Sleeping Beauty's not a particularly interesting, it's not the most interesting fairy tale out there. It's got great visual possibility, which is obviously why they picked it. But that would be the only shortcoming. It's like, why Sleeping Beauty is the story that you want to pump all of this energy into? And I guess, yeah, it is because you have the thorns that kind of, which is part of the story, like the thorns coming out of the ground, and you've got this kind of pretty easy setup so that the visual world can take precedent. But no, I don't, I think that to pursue an aesthetic and to try and perfect it or try to understand it is probably a better way than saying to achieve perfection. I think it's a really noble and interesting pursuit because that's what I know I've done for a lot of my career is I really want to understand and not perfect but grow and develop a visual style so that it's not necessarily my own. It's always kind of influenced by other people or other artists. But it's kind of amazing to be able to look at Sleeping Beauty and to go, that is a Walt Disney picture because of the eyes of the women or the other characters. Like the eyes for me feel like they're a very consistent part of the style, even if the genres and the visual landscapes change. Like it's pretty amazing to kind of be able to bequeath something like that to culture. So I admire it for that.
This is a film now that's 60 years old. Animation has come a long way since it was made. Animation after this film is never going to be the same again, but now we don't even have hand-drawn animation from an American company. It's mostly, you know, Ireland does it or Japan does it. But 60 years on, where do you think this film sits for us? What is there to make of this film in 2021 with everything that has happened in this art form, in this art movement since?
I don't know if this is controversial, but like I wonder whether the developments since films like this were sometimes a hindrance to the form. Because I looked at this and I was like, this feels like how I would love to watch an animation now. Like it doesn't feel dated at all. It feels contemporary in its look. Like there's something about it that is so pure and so, like I said, theatrical or, I don't know, and rich and, as you said, handmade, like the artisanship of the craft, like, fuck, like if we were able to still invest in that on a kind of global level, I feel like you'd get a lot more rich and kind of diverse works of animation. Like I think of things like maybe rotoscoping for me got as close to something like this, like, you know, with a Scanner Darkly. I thought that was a kind of similarly beautiful textured work, but it's a different form. But yeah, no, I don't know. I kind of miss, I like this form, but I'm really old school and I love the illustration. Like, and I think that that's way more exciting than seeing, you know, like a lion speaking, looking real. It's actually very boring, isn't it?
Which, let's not even get started on
the remakes.
That abomination of a film. But I mean, in a way, the thing that makes this film last, as well as the fact that it's such an artistic triumph, is that it's a film that feels like it exists outside of time itself. It feels contemporary because it also feels deeply ancient. It doesn't feel, you know, you can see the sensibilities of the time, like, you know, can see the sensibilities of the 30s in Snow White. You can see the sensibilities of the 50s in Cinderella and Lady and the Tramp. You, like, for most of the Disney cast, and, like, that's not a bad thing about those films at all. Like, those films are all magnificent and they're incredible works of art. But the ones that stick out, films like Fantasia or Pinocchio, or to a certain extent, I would also argue something like Beauty and the Beast and Sleeping Beauty, is that they are films that feel like they exist outside of time itself. They feel like they have, like, Sleeping Beauty is a film that feels like it always has been and always will be. That these characters are now and before and in the future. That they will, it will always, it's a film that will, that speaks to the full scope of human existence, even in this very simplistic, stripped back, highly stylized form.
Yeah, well, they've kind of nailed the brief, which is if you're going to contribute to the mythology of fairy tales and folklore, you don't break a good thing. And so therefore it can be timeless. And weirdly, Disney films are our version of oral histories of these stories, because they are the most kind of like accessible, and they are the most circulated. So we learn about fairy tales through these pieces, which is maybe not necessarily a good thing, but that's the effect of it. That's what and the films that you mentioned, they all have that, because I feel like they nail the brief, which is, you know, this is about collective unconscious. This is about, you know, kind of Jungian philosophy of iconic images of heroes and princesses, etc., that can exist throughout time and can be applied to different time periods, which I guess is the success of their decisions to make those kinds of films.
Now shall you deal with me, O prince, and all the powers of hell!
After one of the final screenings before the release of Sleeping Beauty, Walt Disney stormed out of the screening room in a rage. He accosted a group of animators on the steps, blasting at them that the film was rotten and heavy. The problem was, few at the studio could disagree with him. Sleeping Beauty had taken 7 years to complete and cost $6 million. It had been the longest and most expensive production in the studio's history, the most expensive animated film ever made, and everyone was exhausted and disenchanted with it. Their only hope was that it would all have been worth it. Sleeping Beauty premiered in Los Angeles on January 29, 1959. For its initial run, Buena Vista released the film in both 35mm with a monaural track and 70mm with six-track stereo sound, the latter in a series of showcase screenings. Critics in general were not taken with the film, many of them regarding it as an inadequate copy of Snow White. "Even the drawing in Sleeping Beauty is crude," wrote Time, "a compromise between sentimental crayon book childishness and the sort of cute commercial cubism that tries to seem daring but is really just square." The critic in Harrison's report wrote, "It is doubtful, however, if adults will find as much satisfaction in Sleeping Beauty as they did in Snow White and the Seven Dwarves, with which this latest effort will be assuredly compared, are in many respects similar. While Beauty is unquestionably superior from the viewpoint of the art of animation, it lacks comedy characters that can be compared favourably with the unforgettable Seven Dwarves." In its initial theatrical run, the film only made $5.3 million, which meant that, due to its enormous budget, Sleeping Beauty was not only a box office failure, but a significant one. It is often remarked that Sleeping Beauty was actually the second biggest box office hit of 1959 behind Ben-Hur, and that its failure was due entirely to its inability to cover its budget, but this figure also includes earnings from its release over the last 50 years. Sleeping Beauty not only wasn't the second biggest box office hit of 1959, it didn't even crack the top 10. In fact, it was another Disney production, The Shaggy Dog, that held the number 2 spot that year.
"Princess, if through this wicked witch's trick a spindle should your finger prick, a ray of hope there still may be in this, the gift I give to thee. Not in death, but just in sleep, the fateful prophecy you'll keep. And from this slumber you shall wake, when true love's kiss the spell shall break."
Sleeping Beauty was never re-released in Walt Disney's lifetime. With its return to theatres in 1970, and through many re-releases following, it not only recouped its budget, but became one of the most successful Disney animated films. For many decades, though, it was only seen in Technorama 2.20:1, or a CinemaScope reduction print in 2.35:1, with restorations of the film often using interpositive negatives. For the 50th anniversary restoration in 2009, the original Technicolor negative was used, and Sleeping Beauty was finally released in its full 2.55:1 aspect ratio for the first time since 1959. Today, Sleeping Beauty is regarded as the pinnacle of Disney animation. Seen within the context of the Disney canon, it is a monumental achievement, an all-encompassing cinematic experience whose stripped-back narrative, combined with its medieval style and enormous orchestral score, speak to the primal, brutal heart of fairy tales as foundational texts for the human experience. Walt Disney had intended for it to be his magnum opus, and after many, many decades, that is precisely what many believe it to be. Do you have a favourite Disney animated classic?
Yeah, I do, and it really is Beauty and the Beast.
Obviously, because it's the best, but why Beauty and the Beast?
Do you know what? I think it's because it's the most emotional I've ever felt in an animated film, and I think that that's probably the same for so many people because Disney are masters of emotional manipulation. But it is beautiful, and also I love that they still use, like, I don't know, references to the Cocteau, like the Cocteau film, and like, do you know what I mean? Like, it feels really special, and it feels like something you can enjoy as a kid and as an adult. I think that's why I love it so much. The thing that's so great about it is that you can cry as a kid when you're watching it, but you can also cry as an adult. You can be moved by it, I think. But I'm a real sentimental sucker, so.
My favourite story, I mean, apart from the fact that when I was 5 going to see Beauty and the Beast at cinema, I was so determined to see it that I vomited on the steps of the cinema because I was sick and then demanded I get taken in. My other favourite story, because it's like Beauty and the Beast is in, I mean, I can, you know, it's Beauty and the Beast is far enough away. Beauty and the Beast is not only my favourite Disney film, it's one of my top 10 favourite films of all time. Like, full stop. I think it's a masterpiece, and I think it's one of the greatest films that's ever been made. But one of my favourite stories about it is I used to work at Video Easy back when such things existed. And when Beauty and the Beast was re-released, it was brought out of the vault and released on DVD, and I think it was around the same time it was first released on Blu-ray. And I remember coming into work, and the owner of the store had been working in the store during the day. And I looked up, and I saw that Beauty and the Beast was on the TV. And I was like, oh, that's one of my favourite films. And she said, you know, I've never seen it before, and I've watched it 3 times in a row today. Like, I watched it having never seen it and went, was so taken by it and cried watching it, and I just had to watch it again. She's like, it's amazing. It's an amazing film. And there is something, I mean, jumping very far ahead to when we do it. I mean, I don't know how the fuck we're going to talk about Beauty and the Beast because it's kind of impossible to talk about it articulately without calling, kind of bursting into tears. But there is, in a kind of an extension of, like, if you know, you jump off talking about Aurora and Philip, where it feels like there is a relationship developed between these two characters so that the culmination of that relationship at the end feels to a certain degree slightly more satisfying than you expect. That's the power of Beauty and the Beast. That relationship feels completely earned. And yes, there are lots of complications about that relationship, Stockholm syndrome and all those kind of things, but it's like when they finally come together, you're like, oh, yes, no, every mechanism of this film has earned this. So that when you get to the end and he dies and he comes back to life, you're a fucking blubbering mess because you're like, yeah, that feels right. That's the universe clicking something together.
It also helps that he's the hottest Disney prince of all time.
Is he though?
Yes.
Is he though? I don't know. Like, he's pretty good.
He's pretty good.
I have a soft spot for Philip. I know it's very basic, but I do have a soft spot for Philip.
No, he's very cute.
But also, I mean, do we count Robin Hood as a Disney prince? Because I think everyone will be in agreement that the hottest Disney male character is probably the anthropomorphic fox without pants.
Yeah, true. Because he's like a cheeky little shit, isn't he? Yeah.
Yes.
Of course, get two gay men talking about Disney. This is where it ends up.
It's not the first time, and it won't be the last, that we talk about how hot the fox is in Robin Hood. Stephen, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today about Sleeping Beauty. It's been a real treat. Thank you so much.
Thank you, darling.
Sleeping Beauty was a catastrophe for Walt Disney Productions. Its commercial and critical failure had left Walt and the studio embarrassed. After so much time and so much money, after the breakdowns of creative relationships, the physical and mental strain on the artists involved, heart attacks and chronic injuries and emotional collapses, it had been received with a shrug. And the worst part was, they couldn't really argue with that. They themselves thought the film lacked warmth, that the story was insufficient, that the focus was too much on the fairies and not enough on the barely existent Aurora. Disney couldn't afford to sink this much time and money into a film again. The risk was simply too great. Sleeping Beauty would be the last animated film of its kind. The film had also intended to be Disney's great assault on UPA. But by the time the film was finally released, UPA had fallen apart. A series of distribution and rights issues had gutted the small studio, and they were nothing more than a shadow of the one that had posed such a threat to Disney 7 years before. Sleeping Beauty was supposed to be Walt's ultimate weapon in the battle for dominance, but by the time it was finished, there wasn't anyone to battle with. That year, thanks not just to the failure of Sleeping Beauty, but a number of film projects, the company reported its first annual loss in a decade. Buena Vista alone had lost $900,000. Walt blamed a considerable leaning in the part of the public towards pictures involving violence, sex, and other such subjects. As a result, the studio announced a staggering series of layoffs, reducing the animation staff from over 600 people to under 100. A large portion of the artists who lost their jobs in the fallout from Sleeping Beauty were the women who had trained to help complete the film. "I would venture to guess," said Floyd Norman in 2015, "that women would have played a larger role in Disney animation had it not been for the Sleeping Beauty layoffs in late 1959. Perhaps the greatest repercussion of the failure of Sleeping Beauty, though, was the impact it had on animation itself. It was clear that if feature animation was going to survive at Disney, they needed to find a new cost-effective way to make them, not just in terms of resources, but the size of the staff employed to make them. During the making of Bambi, UB Iwerks had begun experimenting with a process called xerography, a dry photocopying technique that could eliminate the inking stage and photocopy the cleanup animation directly onto a cell. It hadn't worked well enough to use in Bambi, but the studio had tried the process again during the making of Sleeping Beauty to move production along. This time, it had proved successful, and in the aftermath of its release, the Xerox process presented them with an answer to their problem. It was decided that for the next Disney animated feature, the Xerox process would be used. In the process, the entire inking department was closed down. The women that in Sleeping Beauty had properly elevated their techniques to an art form were now no longer called upon to practice their art anymore. And as a result, Sleeping Beauty would be the last work of classic animation ever released by Walt Disney Productions. It had been intended to bring the art of animation to new heights, and instead had blown it apart. The Silver Age of Disney animation now turned in a new direction. The films to come would look nothing like those that had come before, the familiar texture that had become synonymous with Disney. That lush romanticism would now give way to a new, highly graphic, modernist style, one where the principles of Disney and UPA animation would finally collide, and where the art of the animators would be on display like never before. And they would begin with an absolute knockout. A jazzy and vibrant story of a bloodthirsty socialite, two Dalmatians, and many, many, many puppies. On the next episode of Ink and Paint.
For us working as artists, you need to work within your parameters, and you need to squeeze the last drop of everything that you've been given.
I'm joined by production designer, architect, and fashion designer Eugene Tay to look at the sublime canine caper 101 Dalmatians. Thanks again to Stephen Nicolazzo for joining me on this episode. You can learn more about Stephen's work at stephennicolazzo.com and about Little Ones Theatre at littleonestheatre.com.au. Be sure to check out the show notes on this episode at inkandpaint.com.au for more information about the making and release of Sleeping Beauty, including concept art and animation sketches, and information about the history of the film on home video. You can follow Ink and Paint on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at InkPaintPod for bonus material and news on upcoming episodes. You can also email Daniel at inkandpaint.com.au or find me on Twitter at Daniel Lamon. We release new episodes every fortnight, as well as bonus in-betweeners every now and then. So if you enjoyed the show, please rate, review, and subscribe on your favorite podcasting platform. And don't forget to tell your friends. Ink and Paint was created, hosted, and written by myself, Daniel Lamon, and produced and edited by Alex Amster. Theme music is composed by Sam Porter. The show artwork is designed by Nicholas Pirinakis, with episode illustrations by Lily Grace Meek, and the podcast is released through Switch. MakeTheSwitch.com.au. Join in next time on Ink and Paint to continue our journey through the Disney animated classics.
But I just wanted to, the only thing that I knew as a viewer.
No, you go.
This is going to be fun. You go.